endless proof that the Nazis were totally anti-Christian. Okay, this is a quote by General Eric Ludendorff. I adopted it as my view, he wrote, that the Christian doctrine and way of life it had given to the people was the basic cause of the whole evil, and that it served solely as a means for obtaining the Jew the mastery of the world, which had been granted to him by Jehovah. For instance, the Diktat of Versailles was signed on the 28th of June, 1919, the fifth anniversary of the assassination of the Archducal pair at Sarajevo. At the time, I did not suspect the parallelism of the dates, nor have any idea that Kabbalistic beliefs had determined them. Even less did I realize that the murder of the Archducal pair had long been planned by the World Brotherhood of the Freemasons in order to unleash in the Jehovah year 1914 the World War, which had been decided upon by the Grand Orient Lodge of France at Paris and furthered by Rome. Okay, that's a quote by General Eric Ludendorff. He was uplifted by these revelations, for they proved what he had always believed in his heart, that Germany had not lost the war in fair battle, but had been defeated by international Jewry, Freemasonry, and the conspiracies of the Church of Rome. From the book, The Reichsmarschall, A Biography of Hermann Göring by Leonard Mosley, copyright 1974. Okay, this is a quote by Hermann Göring. If the Catholic Christian is convinced that the Pope is infallible in all religious and ethical matters, so we National Socialists declare with the same ardent conviction that for us too, the Führer is absolutely infallible in all political and other matters. So, quote by Hermann Göring, The Face of the Third Reich, Portraits of the Nazi Leadership by Joachim C. Fest, copyright 1970, translated from the German by Michael Bullock. The following was taken from the book, The Third Reich in Power, by Richard J. Evans, copyright 2005. Quote, In his Easter message, written on the 19th of March, 1935, Clemens von Galen, the Bishop of Münster, launched a fierce attack on Rosenberg's book. There are heathens again in Germany, he noted in alarm, and he criticized Rosenberg's idea of the racial soul. Galen wrote personally to Hitler, complaining about attacks on the clergy by leading Nazis such as Baldur von Schirach. Compromise was clearly not in the air. Tightening the screws on the church, Himmler and the Gestapo now began to introduce tougher measures against Catholic lay organizations and institutions, limiting public meetings, censoring the remaining Catholic newspapers and magazines, and banning particular issues, and putting proven Nazis into editorial positions in the Catholic press. On the 4th of November, the regional educational minister made matters far worse by banning the religious consecration of new school buildings and ordering the removal of religious symbols such as crucifixes, and for that matter, portraits of Luther, from all state, municipal, and parish buildings, including schools. Already, since even before the Concordat had been ratified, Cardinal Pacelli, the Vatican Secretary of State in Rome, had been sending a steady stream of lengthy and circumstantially detailed complaints to the German government about such violations, listing hundreds of cases in which the brown shirts had closed down Catholic lay organizations, confiscated money and equipment, engaging in anti-Christian propaganda, banned Catholic publications, and much more. Catholic priests were hindered in this struggle, publicly branding the swastika as the Devil's Cross. The Reich Theater Chamber began from 1935 onwards to ban the church-sponsored musical and also theatrical events, arguing that they were competing financially and ideologically with Nazi-sponsored concerts and plays. By 1937, it was banning nativity plays. After the beginning of Goebbels' campaign against financial corruption in the church, the tone of exchanges between Berlin and Rome became much sharper. Relations seemed to be plunging into open hostility. Church services and sermons in Germany were now, the Vatican complained, being subjected to constant surveillance by the authorities. Matters came to a head when, alarmed at the escalating conflict, a delegation of senior German bishops and cardinals, including Bertram Faulhaber and Galen, went to Rome in January of 1937 to denounce the Nazis for violating the Concordat. Written in German and entitled Mit brennender Sorge, with burning concern, it condemned the hatred and calumny poured on the church by the Nazis. In order to undermine them, however, the encyclical went on, the German government was conducting an annihilatory struggle against the church. With measures of compulsion, both visible and concealed, with intimidation, with threats of economic, professional, civic, and other disadvantages, the doctrinal faithfulness of Catholics, and in particular of certain classes of Catholic civil servants, are being placed under a pressure that is illegal as it is inhuman. Armed since 1936, with his new powers as head of the German police, Himmler now stepped up the campaign against the church. Together with his deputy, Reinhard Heydrich, he placed secret agents in church organizations and escalated police harassment of clerics. There is a definite clampdown on the diocesan press. Restrictions were placed on pilgrimages and processions. Even Catholic marriage guidance and parenthood classes were banned because they did not convey the National Socialist view of these things. By 1938, the majority of Catholic youth groups had been closed down on the grounds that they were assisting in the dissemination of writings hostile to the state. Catholic Action, whose leaders in Germany allegedly maintained communications with Prelate Kass, the former leader of the Center Party, was also banned in 1938. State subsidies for the church were cut in Bavaria and Saxony, and monasteries were dissolved with their assets confiscated. House searches and arrests of political priests underwent a sharp increase with the steady stream of well-publicized cases of abuse of the pulpit brought before the court. Reich propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels also played his part. After the encyclical, he intensified the publicity campaign against the alleged sex scandals involving Catholic priests that had already begun in the middle of 1935. 15 monks were brought before the courts in November 1935 for offenses against the law on homosexuality in a home for the mentally ill in Western Germany. They received seven severe prison sentences and the attention of endless column inches in the press. Other priests were soon being tried for alleged sexual offenses against the minors in the Catholic children's homes and similar institutions. By May of 1936, the press was reporting the trial in Koblenz of over 200 Franciscans for similar crimes. Focusing on allegations of pederasty, the press claimed that the monasteries were breeding grounds of a repulsive epidemic which had to be stamped out. By April 1937, over 1,000 priests, monks, and friars were said to be awaiting trial on such charges. Demanding of the Catholic Church, off with the mask, more than hinting that homosexuality and pedophilia were epidemic in the church as a whole, and not nearly in isolated instances. Particularly offensive, declared the press, was the fact that the church stood behind the accused and treated them as martyrs. As more trials followed, the propaganda ministry built up a steady campaign to portray the church as sexually corrupt and unworthy of being entrusted with the education of the young. Such things only went on in the church where it was suggested they were an inevitable byproduct of the celibacy that was required of the priesthood by the church. The Catholic Church was a sore on the healthy racial body that had to be removed, declared one article in the Nazi press. The campaign culminated in a furious speech by the Reich propaganda minister himself, delivered to an audience of 20,000 of the party faithful and broadcast on national radio on the 28th of May, 1937, denouncing Catholic corruptions and poisoners of the people's soul, and promising that this sexual plague must be exterminated root and branch. It is not the law of the Vatican that rules here among us, he warned the church, but the law of the German people. The Nazis now launched a sustained campaign to close denominational schools and replace them with non-religious community schools, backed by votes from parents. Already beginning in 1936, Cardinal Bertram had complained directly to Hitler of the unheard-of terror which was being practiced in Bavaria, Württemberg, and elsewhere. His appeal fell on deaf ears. The campaign continued. "We don't want to let the chaplain teach us anymore," children were reported as saying by the leading Nazi daily paper on the 25th of May 1937 under the headline, "Entire school class defends itself against sex offender in priest's clothing." By the summer of 1939, all denominational schools in Germany had been turned into community schools, and all private schools run by the churches had been closed down, and the monks and priests who staffed them dismissed. Pastors and priests were prevented from teaching in primary schools in increasing numbers. At the same time, religious instruction classes were reduced in number. In similar vein, the education ministry drew up plans to merge or close down many of the theological faculties in the universities, while from 1939, theology posts and teacher training colleges that fell vacant were no longer filled, by order of the education ministry in Berlin. In a few areas, notably in Württemberg, where the educational minister, Mergenthaler, was strongly anti-Christian, there were attempts to abolish religious instruction and replace it with classes on the Nazi worldview. The regime did not succeed in abolishing religious education altogether by 1939, but its long-term intentions had become abundantly clear by this date. The power of the Catholic Church in Germany, like that of its Protestant counterpart, had been severely dented by 1939. It had been intimidated and harassed until it began to scale down its criticisms of the regime for fear that even worse might follow. Widespread threats of imprisonment, reported a local government official towards the end of 1937, had produced a cautious restraint on the part of the clergy. In some areas, the Gestapo took over the anti-church campaign and rapidly succeeded in driving the Catholic Church out of public life. I love it. From Rome, Cardinal Pacelli continued to send interminable letters of complaint to the German government, charging it with continued violations of the Concordat. Yet, although he contemplated doing so in September 1937, Hitler in the end refrained from openly repudiating the Concordat. It was not worth the risk of arousing the hostility of the Vatican and the protests of the Catholic states, particularly Austria, in the increasing delicate state of international relations in the late 1930s. Privately, however, the foreign ministry made no bones about the fact that it regarded the Concordat as out of date because of its provisions, particularly concerning education, were fundamentally opposed to the basic principles of National Socialism. It was easier to proceed piecemeal and by stealth and avoid all mention of the Concordat. In public, Hitler continued to call for the Church's loyalty and to point out that it still received substantial state support. In the long run, however, he made it clear in private that it would be completely separated from the state, deprived of income from state taxes, and become a purely voluntary body along with its Protestant equivalent. As Rosenberg declared in 1938, since young people were now under the control of the Hitler Youth and the Nazified educational system, the hold of the church over its congregation would be broken and the Catholic and confessing churches would disappear from the life of the people in their present form. It was a sentiment from which Hitler himself did not dissent. Balder von Schirach, urging young people in 1934 to leave Catholic youth organizations and join the Hitler Youth, declared that Rosenberg's path is the path of the German youth. In July of 1935, at the height of the controversy over Rosenberg's attacks on the churches, a speaker told a meeting of the Nazi Students League in Bernau, "One is either a Nazi or a committed Christian. Christianity," he said, "promotes the dissolution of racial ties and of the national racial community. We must repudiate the Old and New Testaments, since for us the Nazi idea alone is decisive. For us there is only one example, Adolf Hitler and no one else." Such anti-Christian ideas were widespread in the Hitler Youth and formed an increasingly important part of the party's program for the indoctrination of the young. Children receiving lunches from the National Socialist Welfare Organization in Cologne, for example, were obliged to recite a grace before and after the meal, which substituted the Führer's name for God's and when thanks were given. At one training camp for school children in Freisburg, they were told that the Pope was a half-Jew and that they had to hate the Jewish racially alien teaching of Christianity, which was incompatible with National Socialism. The mother of a 12-year-old Hitler youth found the following text in his pocket when he came home one evening. The song was also sung in public by the Hitler youth at the 1934 Nuremberg Party Rally. "We are the jolly Hitler youth. We don't need any Christian truth. For our leader Adolf Hitler, our leader always our interceder. Whatever the papist priest may try, we're Hitler's children until we die. We follow not Christ but horse vessel, away with the incense and the water vessel. As sons of our forebears, from times gone by, we marched as we sing with banners held high. I'm not a Christian nor a Catholic. I go with the SA through thick and thin. Not the cross they sang, but the swastika is redemption on earth." Such propaganda also propagated fiercely anti-Christian ethic whose virulence and potency should not be underestimated. Watching a young Hitler Youth member enter a Munich classroom in August of 1936, Friedrich Reck Malexeven observed how his glance fell on the crucifix hanging behind the teacher's desk, how in an instant his young and still soft face contorted in fury, how he ripped this symbol, to which the cathedrals of Germany and the ringing progressions of the St. Matthew are consecrated, off the wall, and threw it out of the window into the street, with the cry, "Lie there, you dirty Jew!" And there were other outspokenly anti-Christian figures within the Nazi leadership besides Schirach. Open paganism in the party, championed by Erich Ludendorff in the mid-1920s, did not disappear with Ludendorff's foundation of the Tannenberg League in 1925 and his expulsion from the party 2 years later. Robert Ley, leader of the Labor Front, went even further than Rosenberg in his disdain for Christianity and his rejection of the divinity of Christ, though he did not follow him down the road of creating a substitute religion. A more consistently paganist figure in the Nazi elite was the party's agricultural expert, Richard Walther Dare, whose ideology of blood and soil made such a powerful impression on Heinrich Himmler. Dare believed that the medieval Teutons had been weakened by their conversion to Christianity, which he claimed had been foisted on them by the effete Latins from southern Europe. As an SS plan put it in 1937, "We live in the age of the final confrontation with Christianity. It is part of the mission of the SS to give the German people over the next 50 years the non-Christian ideological foundations for a way of life appropriate to their own character." The families of SS men were ordered by Himmler not to celebrate Christmas, but to mark Midsummer instead. Christianity, Himmler was to declare on the 9th of June, 1942, was the greatest of plagues. The Interior Ministry ruled that people leaving the church should declare themselves to be deist, Gottglaubig, and the party decreed that office holders could not simultaneously hold any office in the Catholic or Protestant church. This process was accelerated by an escalating series of measures pushed by the energetic and strongly anti-Christian head of Rudolf Hess's office, Martin Bormann, banning priests and pastors from playing a part in party affairs, or even after May 1939, from belonging to it altogether. It remained the case that the Nazi Party was on the way to severing all its ties with organized Christianity by the end of the 1930s. Among Catholic workers in the Ruhr, by contrast, there were reports of worries that Hitler's success would lead to an even more ruthless campaign against the Church. From the book The Spear of Destiny by Trevor Ravenscroft, copyright 1973. The capital S for Satanic and Satanism are mine, out of respect for our God. Okay, that's my note. I refuse to lowercase Satanism and stuff like the Jews do in writing their stuff. Well, at any rate. Oh, here's the quote from the book. Unlike Roman Catholic priests, malevolent parasites, and Puritan pastors, submissive as dogs who sweat in embarrassment when you talk to them, Hitler refused to accept the story of the ancient Hebrews as in any way of positive significance in the long history of mankind. There was no need, as far as he was concerned, to assess the value of Christianity, because Nietzsche had already done it to a perfection in a masterful analysis of this religion for slaves, weaklings, and the desiccated residue of racial scum. Heilscher was also responsible for creating the ritual of the stifling air in which select members of the SS took oaths of irreversible allegiance to satanic powers. Had the Nazis won the war, Heilscher may have become high priest of a new world religion that would have replaced the cross with a swastika. Hitler hated Christ and felt only scorn and contempt for all Christian aims and ideals. Okay, here's a quote by Dietrich Eckhart. Yet those who saw him apparently immersed in the gay social round of the Munich beer kellers never guessed that behind that jovial facade of this veteran army officer was hidden a dedicated Satanist, the supreme adept of the arts and rituals of black magic, and the central figure in a powerful and widespread circle of occultists, the Tula group. Okay, I'm sorry, I made a mistake here. I'm not going to go back and read this all over again. Dietrich Eckhart, it was a quote from the book concerning Dietrich Eckhart. Okay, so I made a mistake here. It was not a quote from Dietrich Eckhart. This is a quote about Dietrich Eckhart from the book. Alright, after the war, when captured by the Allies, in full view of the guards of the condemned cells, who were watchful mainly for the passing of poisons through which their charges might evade the gallows, Wolfram von Sievers knelt in reverence, whilst Heilscher incanted the words of a black mass, a final hymn to worship to the powers of evil awaiting his soul on the other side of the grave. Eckhart was on the lookout for quite another sort of pupil. He claimed to his fellow adepts that in the Tulis group that he had personally received a kind of satanic annunciation, that he was destined to prepare the vessel of the Antichrist, the man inspired by Lucifer to conquer the world and lead the Aryan race to glory. As Dietrich Eckhart lay dying in 1923, he said, "Follow Hitler, he will dance, but it is I who have collected the tune. But it is I who have called the tune. I have initiated him into the secret doctrine, opened his centers in vision, and given him the means to communicate with the powers. Do not mourn for me. I shall have influenced history more than any other German." Okay, excuse me for some mistakes here. I've read tons of these in the past several days. I keep doing so. And I messed up on that. And that was a quote about Dietrich Eckhart. And Dietrich Eckhart was definitely a devout Satanist, and he was also an adept at black magic.